Hey everyone, welcome back to the Gary V Audio Experience. And before this episode starts, I just want to remind you to please leave your comments for today's episode in the Spotify Q&A section down below. But also tweet Gary your feedback at Gary V and let him know what you thought about today's episode.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Welcome, Gary. Welcome to Singapore.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a little bit of a fireside chat today. I wanted to have ChatGPT on stage with us, but I didn't pay for the pro version, so we couldn't make it. But thank you for hosting us in your offices, VaynerX and VaynerMedia. Please think of that whenever you have needs. Mazel tov. Tell us about, we've got themes for the questions today. So this theme is Gary V, the person. The next theme will be how do you get in the room and so on. But let's start with Gary V, the person. What is that thing that people misunderstand about you the most? So what is that thing that people wish, you wish that people knew about you? There's so much to you, author, philosopher, you know, entrepreneur, investor, patient but relentless. Tell us.
First of all, thank you for being here. I hope everything's going well. You know, I think one of the unique things that very good parenting and the luck of the draw of DNA and circumstance brings is even the question of what do you wish people knew? I don't really have a great wish of what people knew, or I don't have really passion for anything other than a very selfish and selfless framework of I'd like to do the things that make me happy. And I'd like to communicate the perspectives and the frameworks that allow me to be so happy and content. And that's kind of just how I live my life. So I think the thing that most people would be surprised about is as someone who's so high energy and is such a talker and, you know, has all the DNA traits that I have as a communicator, I'm actually incredibly simple. I see things very simple. I have very, you know, a lot of times my employees get asked like, what's he really like? Or people, you know, things that, you know, it's very simple. I'm passionate about doing good things, enjoying my process. I don't have a whole lot of anxiety or stress, even though I do so many things and have plenty of complications because I keep life very basic. And so, you know, I don't have any wants or needs of how I'm perceived. I'm humbled and appreciative when people are interested in the things that I've done. I'm empathetic and understanding if people are dismissive or not interested in it. And I just kind of like do my thing.
And did it take you a long time to get to that state of simple and zen? Because, you know, there's a quote. I wanted to write you a short letter, but I didn't have time, so I wrote you a long letter. And that simplicity, is that a metaphor for?
I actually think that it wasn't that. It was, I've always basically have lived in a cocoon. You know, I grew up in a very specific circumstance. I was born in the Soviet Union. I came to the US in the late 70s. We were very poor. I lived with, you know, 7-8 family members in a studio apartment in Queens. I learned at a very young age that money had no correlation to happiness. We had nothing and I was as happy as one could be. I cared about my family. I wanted to help my family. I spent the first 12 years of my professional career building my dad's liquor business for him. I didn't even think about the things that are happening with me. I think that it was just always a part of me. I think it was what we all know. It was A, my natural DNA, B, how I was parented, and then C, my environment that I grew up in. And I think it created a unique framework that was built on not overvaluing things that didn't matter. I've never thought about buying things for the sake of communicating. I think that's a huge vulnerability in society. I don't think humans understand how much money they spend to try to show that they're successful or happy. I just think it was circumstantial.
And there is a quote that I think was by, could have been by ChatGPT or attributed to you. How can you beat me when I'm playing my own game? Does that tie into this thinking?
Yeah, I think, to your point, I think the thing that I would wish on all of you is detachment. Detachment is very powerful. I enjoy my process so much that I'm incapable of factoring in your opinion, whether pro or con. So much of what works for me as a public figure is that I don't hear the accolades. When I sit here and I'm introduced, I don't think, there's no pride in being a successful entrepreneur. I really mean that. And it's kind of an interesting framework. Like, I genuinely don't think it means much. Why that's powerful is it gives you incredible strength on the other side. When you don't hear the cheering, you don't hear the booing. And so I think what's made what I do sustainable is I'm playing my own game. You can't beat someone who doesn't care. Which is so counterintuitive, right? Doesn't mean I don't have passion or conviction, but the thought that being a business person is like that serious just doesn't register for me, even though it's my life's work.
So they said that in Steve Jobs' gravity distortion field, he used to say to people like Steve Wozniak, don't be afraid, you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think on that front, life is what you decide it is. The human perspective is the ultimate weapon. I always say that you find what you're looking for. If you think the world sucks, good news. Turn on the television, grab your phone, go on social media, go pick up a newspaper, and in 20 minutes, you will see that the world sucks. Comma, if you decide the world is the best, good news. Turn on the television, go grab the newspaper, go grab your phone and go on social media, and you can find that the world is the best. And I am fascinated by that variable. And I think the reason I'm extremely successful in business is I'm a practical optimist. I always think it's good. I always think there's an opportunity. Like, for example, what's going on in the world right now? Like, all my friends are like, Gary, what do you think about the banking system? I'm like, I think it's gonna be good. They're like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, I don't know, like, what's the problem? Like, you know, like, people make up, there are people hitting me up about Silicon Valley Bank that don't have any money. Like, this is a real, like people make up narratives that have no logic to them. And so, you know, I think when I have conversations like this, the reason I like to go as heady as I'm going right now is everything else we can talk about is a commodity. Like, the tactics are the commodity. Like, what do you want to know? How to market better, how to hire and fire, like how to create product market fit? All of that has been commoditized. Especially in a ChatGPT world. You don't even, you remember when we went from encyclopedias to Google and it was like, whoa? Well, now you could be like ChatGPT, da-da-da-da-da. It'll give you the answer. That's like, the way I think about business is the way I think about being in shape. How can all of us in this room be in better shape in a year from now? Let me tell you how. You need to eat better, have a higher percentage of protein, less carbs and sugar. You need to go to the gym, you need to burn calories, you need to sleep better, and everybody here will be in more shape. Now the interesting part, go and do it. When we talk about business, there's nothing profound. I can give you, like, the reason I've enjoyed being in an agency is every client I meet with, I can give you the answer. It's not very hard to reverse engineer a business. What's hard is the process. And for us, a lot of us as entrepreneurs, you're competing with yourself. The amount of energy entrepreneurs put into the people they compete with is one of my most interesting things that I spend time on. There is nobody that is taking your growth away from you. You do not have one competitor, because the world is not a zero-sum game. The thing that's holding people back from building a bigger business is themselves. Because if you're spending 6 hours a day worried about your competitor, well, they've already accomplished their goal. If you spend zero, you now have allocated all your time to building what you want to build. One of my most challenging questions for 25 years in business has been when people ask me about my competitors, because I don't know. I never know, because it's completely and utterly irrelevant.
Was it early in your life that you had such certainty that this is the way you operate?
Yeah, the thing that I've always been most fascinated about the course of my life is today, it's a more logical and interesting conversation of debating higher education, right? Smart kids around the world are debating the ROI of university and college in a way that we haven't seen since the late 40s and early 50s. For me, a first generation immigrant in the 80s and 90s, it was as foreign as walking on the moon to not go to the best college you could go to. And yet, by fifth grade, I knew that it wasn't for me and that it would have absolutely no impact on my life. So somewhere very early on, I realized that I believed the market more than I believed my teachers and my friends' parents. That my teachers and my friends' parents told me that I was going to be a loser, but that every time I sold lemonade or sports cards or washed people's cars or shoveled their snow, I did it better than anybody. And so very early on, I knew that I wanted to be of the market, not of the grown-ups that didn't see the market.
I mean, it's fascinating, right? So like you had all the variables together to make it work. So getting it done to the point, and then how do people and the teams around you, how do you get them organized and synergized and aligned to a vision and build all these huge things that you built?
Usually it starts with empathy. So when I was 14 years old, the first time I worked at my dad's liquor store, he didn't say a single thing to me on our 40-minute drive to the store until we got to the parking lot. And then he turned to me and he looked at me and he said, "Keep an eye on the employees, they all steal." Why I just brought up that story, for my father, as I'm older now, I understand him. At the time, I was very emotional about this. For my father, his employees were the enemy. For me, my employees are my family. The way I think about getting team members on board is by caring more about their needs than mine. Most operators and business owners think that just because they pay someone, that they should be doing what they want them to do. I think this is an incredible, vulnerable framework. People talk about wanting their employees to be loyal, yet they're not loyal, right? People talk about, my favorite one, very common question I get, "Gary, how do I get my employees to work as hard as I do?" My reply on email, to make them equal partners. I think we have audacity at the ownership level, at the leadership level. And so I think the answer to your question is, the way I do it is through empathy and compassion and putting myself in their shoes and asking why would they want to be on board. I reverse engineer their emotional graph, and then on an individual basis, I try to understand where they are on their journey. Sometimes kids come into my company, and the first time I sit down with them, they say to me, one day I'm gonna run this whole company. And I'm thrilled. I'm like, please, I'm getting old, you know? That same employee, 5 years later sometimes, walks into my office and says, I need more work-life balance. Because now they fell in love, and they're starting a different chapter of their life. And I love that. I don't judge them for not wanting to work 14 hours a day anymore. I respect that that's their interest. I think it's a leader's obligation to reverse engineer the wants and needs of the people on their team, not only philosophically, but in reality on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's a very, very hard thing to do, but I think it's required to build something big.
And the patterns of the questions that you ask to get that loyalty, that mutual dedication to each other in this shared purpose.
That's very easy. When you have the intent to care, you ask the questions. You know, when people come up with excuses of why they haven't accomplished something, it's often predicated on the fact that they didn't want to know the answer at the time. Do you know how many business owners avoid one-on-one conversations with their employees because they're scared they're gonna ask for a raise? So that one's very easy. It's called intent.
Are there patterns in companies at different sizes and scale? Do you see different core issues within the...
Of course. One of the hardest things for a room like this to do to build scale is letting go. You know, people want to micromanage because they don't realize their ego is tied up in it. People that start businesses have incredible pride in being the best at the thing, to the demise of scale. So I think there's a family business or a small business has very different dynamics than a corporation. But to make it contextual for this room, when I don't really coach or mentor, but I have so many friends and relationships. And given the nature of my life, as you can imagine, over dinner or sometimes wine, I find myself in that mode with my friends, and I'm thrilled to do it. Anytime someone says that they're not growing to the level of their ambition or hopes and dreams, 99 out of 100 times, it's based on ego. It's they're incapable of creating scale because they fear scale, because they fear it in two ways. One is a very good one. They're scared that if they're not doing it, the client is not getting the quality of execution that they're accustomed to, which is coming from a very noble place, but is required to make scale. Or two, they don't realize how much pride they have in telling everybody that works for them that they're better at the thing than all of them. Both of it comes from a place of fear. And so, you know, I think a lot about that when I talk to businesses that entrepreneurs run. I'm trying to understand, can they see that fear is dictating them, thus having them on defense versus offense? Most entrepreneurs and small businesses want to win the game 1-0. They don't realize that that's what they're doing, but that's what they're doing. And I think for me, I want to win the game 17-14, 39-32, 116-104. Most people don't have the appetite to make 104 mistakes.
Knowing what you know now, at what point would you, this is a mixed group, you've got entrepreneurs, coaches, mentors, investors, and leaders of MNCs, right? So it's also interesting to think of how to bring the right questions to the audience, but at what point did you know that it was time to scale the various projects that you have, the businesses, the investments? Like, what was that inflection point? mentioned product market fit? Was it something that the market told you or you tell us?
To answer your question directly, there's never been a day that I haven't thought about growing the business to the extreme highest levels of what I could accomplish.
Even in the wine shop before you went online?
Of course. The day I started working for my dad, I said, one day I'm gonna build the biggest liquor store in the world. That was like there's never been a time where I understood why wouldn't you?
Did he understand where you were coming from? Like, did he react to that?
You know, my dad is a really interesting case study for me because he came to America with nothing and built a really meaningful life and was on pure offense and then hit a point where it all became full defense. He, you know, and it's a very common immigrant story. Like, you know, you see a lot of people, and it's not just an immigrant story, it's probably very real for a lot of people here. You hit a place where you have scratched your itch. And I think that comes with people making goals that are arbitrary. I think the reason that I have never felt that feeling is I've never created a goal for myself. It's never been like, I wanna make $100 million, or I wanna have 1,000 employees, or it's always been like, I just wanna wake up and play. I need to do my thing. I want to build businesses every day. And so, you know, for me, it was funny when you asked the question, what my brain said to myself is like, you're asking me if I've ever thought about breathing oxygen. That's literally how, what I thought when you asked that, right? When you said, when did you know what the inflection point was? I'm like, I don't know. The same time I thought about breathing was a good idea to stay alive. Like, there is no other option. Why wouldn't you continue to build if you could?
And did you ever think of stopping that particular strategy of business and trying something new?
All the time. I think one of the things that's really interesting about being an entrepreneur is when you're actually a purebred entrepreneur, by nature, you're much more creative than I think we talk about it. There's a level of creativity that we don't talk enough about that comes along with entrepreneurship. And so for me, one of the potential negatives of being overly creative is you're constantly curious and thinking about other shit you could be doing. I have figured out something really good for me. I just have 7 trillion businesses. I'm aware that I'm not maximizing the revenue and the profits out of every one of them because I have too many of them, but that's what makes me happy. I would rather make less money and have 20 businesses than make more. So many of my friends who are really significantly successful individuals, I'm talking the people that own sports franchises, they're like, if you would just focus on one business, you would blah, blah, blah. And I always say to them, I'm like, but I wouldn't like it as much. And I think one of the great mistakes that half-pregnant entrepreneurs make is they make it about how much money they make, not about how much they like it.
And so that's a very broad perspective that you bring. So let's take it back again to some of the early days. You were an early investor in some of the name brand companies that we know, like Uber and Airbnb and a couple. How did you get in the group? Like, do you have any advice for the entrepreneurs waiting in the wings, perhaps?
Well, the first 3 companies I invested in 2006 and 2007 were Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. So I came out the gate pretty good. But like how I got in the room is insane. I made a video that said Facebook should be worried about Twitter. And I posted it on YouTube. And so the moral of that story is there's a lot of ways to get into a room, but the fastest way to get into a room is to talk about the room you want to get into and post it on the internet. I continue to be fascinated by people's disrespect of social media. I'm fascinated by this. People continue to not understand that communication dictates the world. It is how the world exists. For example, the world is a highly religious world. Our world, the earth, the 8 billion people on earth. Religion is one of the most significant frameworks of our society as human beings. One of the biggest reasons that's true is that when the printing press was invented, the far majority of the first books that were made were done by the churches and the mosques and the city. Like, you have to understand that social media has completely changed the landscape of geopolitics. We are talking about communication, from religion to government to why everybody is wearing the clothes that they're wearing right now. That is all based on communication. So for me, the thing that I would encourage all of you is everyone in this room, me included, and I'm profound at it, is under communicating on the internet in the seeking of joy. You would not believe how much can be accomplished if you just started making videos, writing blog posts, or doing audio of your thoughts around your passions or the places you're interested in. You wanna be an investor in AI? Start making green screen commentary about AI and post it on LinkedIn and watch what happens. Everyone's trying to get to things through other people, networking, when the ultimate networking is just posting something on a social media platform and letting the merit of your thoughts and your strategies drive it. So, you know, I got into the room by sharing my opinions. Luckily, my opinions were grounded in some sort of intellect and logic, and it meant that smart people saw it and led to opportunity for me. The way I invested in Facebook was, I made a video called Twitter is a Problem for Facebook. I talked about the fact that Twitter was mobile centric and that I thought the mobile phone was gonna be a big deal. And somebody from Facebook sent me an email and asked me if I'd wanted to come to Facebook and talk about what I saw. I flew to Palo Alto. They had 350 employees at the time. I sat like this in front of 300 people. I talked for an hour about consumer behavior and really emotional intelligence and why I thought social networks were gonna matter. And Mark Zuckerberg was in the crowd and came down and said, do you wanna have dinner? We had dinner that night. We aligned our points of view, were very similar onto where the world was going. And that was a couple months later, he called me and said, do you wanna buy some shares of Facebook? My parents are trying to sell some shares. That's not me like going to 20 VC conferences and passing out my business card. And that was 2006. What I just described is even more real today. You are literally one video away from having what you want to happen. It's just that nobody's making the video.
And so once you're in that room and you're presented with various opportunities, how did you evaluate the deals? How did you decide this was the one for you or not? This was the founder that you wanted to buy into or not? Like, do you have any advice that you can share with us?
I'm a big fan of the requirement of liking the jockey and the horse. I feel like you have to like the entrepreneur and the business idea. And I think a lot of us as investors, me included, lose our way sometimes of overly liking the jockey or overly liking the horse and not matching them up. I went from really smart investing to very bad investing because my fatal flaw of investing in 2008 was I put myself in the position of the CEO of what I would do with the idea, and I underestimated how strong of an operator I was, and I overestimated my ability to guess if somebody was a good operator. And after 3 or 4 years of that, I went back to investing in liking the idea, but liking the entrepreneur, and I started getting much bigger returns again. And so for the investors in this room, one man's point of view of what really has worked for me, and really I've observed from others that I think have had some success, is there's so many options of things to invest in. Why wouldn't you only invest in when you adore the operator and the idea? And I think we compromise sometimes on one or the other.
I, actually had a theme for one of the questions. It was WWGD, what would Gary do, you know, in a situation? So if you're confronted with perhaps one of your investments or somebody you're advising, and they are in a mess, or you know, they're experiencing challenges, where do you start? Do you start with strategy? Do you start with tactics? How do you start to diagnose a problem and then give them the right advice for them?
For me, and this will probably make sense for if you were listening to the first 15 minutes of this chat, for me, I start with the person and their emotional state, like who they are as a human being. Most of the problems with a business are 100% attributable to the leader and what she or he is going through. So usually when I'm on a board, or if I have a big investment and I care, or I just like the person and I care, it's usually a little bit of like, why are you doing this? Some people are scared of conflict. Some people get high on their own supply. Some people were just not meant for this line of work. You know, one of the challenging things that happened in the last decade was entrepreneurship became so cool that people forced themselves to be entrepreneurs. There was an extraordinary era in the last 10 years of people that started companies that really are number fours and number sevens and number 12s. Being a number one is lonely. Like, you have to be a very specific person to actually be a successful entrepreneur. And I think, you know, when I'm met with somebody who's struggling, I'm trying to figure them out, because the next part of like what's wrong with the business is a lot easier to address than what's wrong with the leader.
And is it different if the person has been successful and now they're experiencing some challenges?
You know, obviously, and I think everybody understands, literally every word out of my mouth is also contextual, right? And so sometimes, like, there have been people who actually have been lucky with timing and were in the right place at the right time. You know, there's just like, there's a lot of variables. I find that people that have already had a success, when they're struggling with the second one, three things are happening. One, it's just a moment in time and they need more time to get it there because they actually can operate. Two, they just got lucky of time. And lucky is a tough word, I don't like saying that. They did a much better job the first time on being in the right place at the right time, which is a skill, so I don't wanna say luck. Or three, they think they're a big shot because they already had an exit or success, and they're delusional and overdriven by ego and have lost touch with the consumer. And so they're just operating poorly off of something they did well 10 years ago. One of my favorite things about the way I operate is that I don't think anything that happened yesterday back means anything for what I'm doing right now. I don't think because I've been successful that I'm guaranteed to be successful. And I think a lot of founders on their second time in this scenario are incredibly audacious that something worked for them the first time, which makes them not have the level of humility required to be a strong operator. I think humility, David, is really one of the most significant traits to build something meaningful that people really struggle with when they've had success. It's hard. You believe in people's affirmation of yourself. You believe in the press clippings. You believe in the accolades. You believe that it had anything to do. You know why I think this has always worked for me? It's because I like sports. Like, Muhammad Ali lost to average boxers in the end of his career. Like, Michael Jordan wasn't Michael Jordan on the Wizards that he was on the Bulls. Like, every athlete eventually gets to a place where they're not as good as they were the way we knew them. That happens with entrepreneurs too, but we can't see it because businesses are more hidden than sports. But I really hold on to that truth, and so that keeps me very motivated to be sharp and humble.
So do you resonate with the phrase, always hire people who are smarter than you and just bring in talent and never be threatened by just assembling the best team you can?
Yeah, but I also don't think it's that romantic. I don't think it's about smarter. I think it's that you just need lots of different skill sets to make something work. I don't think just because somebody's better at math than me and I want them to be my CFO that they're smarter than me. I just think that, as a matter of fact, I actually usually think it's the other way. I think most people are one-dimensional and they have a very core strength, thus making them very viable as a piece of a team, and that actually the smartest is the one that knows how to cook the ingredients of the people. So for the people that struggle with like, I don't wanna hire smarter people than me, well then just reframe the question that you're not hiring people that are smarter, you're just the architect of the way you're gonna build the house. The architect doesn't have to be the best mason. The architect doesn't have to be the best floor placer. The architect doesn't have to be the best painter. The architect needs to be the fucking architect.
And does kind candor, is this a good point to like segue to kind candor and how you use that with this cross-functional team of specialists or some polymaths, I guess?
So I wrote a book a couple years ago called 12 and a half, and it talks about 13 traits that I feel, in my subjective opinion, really matter in being able to build businesses. And the reason I called it 12 and a half was my hypothesis is like, look, these are the things that stand out to me, but all of us are on a journey of being good or bad or in between with them. And my half, hence I'm not good at it, is actually very ironic, is candor. As a public figure in this environment with my client, I'm incredibly strong at candor. With my employees and the people I love, I'm really bad at it. And it's really been a shortcoming of my career. And there's a lot to it. I think that my father was very good at candor, but the way he delivered it was so different than what I believe in that I demonized the candor, not the mechanism that was delivering. And I couldn't separate it at that point in my life. I also don't think it comes natural to me. I have a lot of my mom's DNA. It doesn't come natural to her. I also never was driven by money. So I was able to waste money on people because I wasn't driven by it. And so it allowed me to avoid candor because I didn't mind wasting money if I liked someone. And so there's all these things that came to it. Once I redefined it for myself as kind candor, it's amazing how back to communication and positioning, just by putting the word kind in front of candor, it transformed my career.
What was the tipping point for that?
Being accountable that people that worked for me, that knew me, didn't like me, and that made no sense to me because I have such good intent and I love everybody. And I had to be accountable to why are there people on earth that work directly for me that are mad at me? Why don't they like, that's impossible, that makes no sense. I had to be accountable. And in that journey of getting older, more mature, more thoughtful, what happened was I'm like, oh my God, every single person has the same issue, which was I would tell them, I love you, you're the best, everything's awesome. And on Thursday, I would say to Andre, like, love you, pal, da da da. And then on Monday, he'd come in, I'd be like, Andre, we need to talk. I'm like, you're fired. And like, there was like, people were like, what the fuck are you talking about? 2 days ago, you said I was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I would not be accountable in my 20s and 30s and be like, how did Andre not realize he's been sucking for 5 years? Like, he stinks. And I wasn't accountable to the fact that I wasn't able to give critical feedback and position the exit in a respectful manner because I didn't like the feeling of it. I avoided it at all costs. And then because I never wanted to go out of business, I would do it, but I would do it so sloppy. It would be such a mess, David. And I finally just got to a point in my career where I was like, you know, I don't want that. Like, this is not good. I'm going around the world in settings like this, talking about all the things, but this thing's a weakness of mine. And so I worked on it and I marketed to myself. I worked on it. I repositioned it. I scaled it inside our company. I still am not great at it, but man, I used to be a one or two at it. Now I'm a six or seven And in that one to, or in two to six and seven, it's completely transformed my results. And kind candor has been a blessing to my career. And I think for all of us, if this story resonates, I encourage you at all costs to take a step back. Because I think we all know this. We can all lie to ourselves, but deep down we always know. And every one of us here knows what we're not doing well. And I think there's an opportunity always to get better. And you should fight for it. And I think accountability is very attractive and leads to a lot of happiness. And even though it was a painful transition for me to really have those challenging conversations with myself about what I was doing wrong in the face of a lot of success, it's made me a dramatically happier person and a more successful person. And I know all of us here have things to work on, and I think I encourage that.
And I imagine a company that has this kind of trust and this kind of candor as a way of working versus one that's not. And then imagining how that company performs in the market and the trust that it can build with its audience because it's authentic internally and it's authentic externally. Do you think that that's important for companies as, you know, we get the operations and how they perform in the marketplace and how they build trust and rapport with their customers? Stakeholders, do you see that as a key success factor?
Yeah, I think that everything starts at home. If you internally aren't built on a good foundation, it's gonna be very hard for you to sustainably be strong with your customer. You could do it for a while, but it will fold in the end. And so, yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Do you see that as part of the issues right now that we're seeing with recessions and retrenchments and pretty harsh realities?
No, I think that's more based on the delusion of the financial infrastructure that runs the world. I think what we're dealing with now is governments printed money during COVID because nobody's willing to have hardship anymore. I think what we're dealing with now is based on the fact that people are not interested in being inconvenienced. We're in a very interesting time in society where globally, at scale, the world is collectively entitled. So what we're dealing with now is governments are printing money at scale. And so you're gonna have sharp inflations and recessions when nothing makes sense. There were multiple countries around the world where people were getting paid more to stay home than to work. That's a problem. And we're paying that piper. And by the way, all that money that the government sent to people to stay home, they went out and bought Dom Perignon and Nike and Louis Vuitton. So, no, I think that's just the world is fucked up when it comes to money.
Do you think that this current situation presents opportunities? Are there any ideas or guidance that you can share with entrepreneurs or business leaders here on how to take advantage of the current situation?
There's never a good time to start a bad business. Equally, there's never a bad time to start a good business. Of course, there's opportunity right now. The best part of recessions or global economic challenges is that C players get smoked out. Yeah, my preference is sustained recessions in perpetuity because I grow during those times.
And is it because you invest or you look for, how do you target growth during difficult times? Is that just like one of the many secrets?
Being very good at what you do. Like, you have to understand, when there's money flowing, it's like your friends that are real estate agents. You know how like, you know real estate's a weird game? It's when your friends that are just okay are making tons of money. Like, That's how it is during good times. When there's good times and money's flowing, even C and D players make money. My secret is have a good business. Be better. You know, that goes into a lot of stuff we talked about for the last half an hour, but that's what happens during times like this. During tough times, the best players pick up market share. That's what always happens.
Does anybody have any questions? Does anybody who doesn't have a question? Alice, please.
Hi, Gary.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, my name is Alice. I'm not an aspiring serial entrepreneur. I'm actually an aspiring writer and housewife.
Amazing.
But what I really like about you is that you are so yourself, you know, like what you say, you don't care, you know? But then when you preach on social media, how do you separate that it's really intuition from your, I would say, higher source, or when it's ego and narcissism, and how do you prevent yourself from taking advantage of your followers, like manipulation, you know, crypto stuff?
It's a great question. I think it's similar. You know how earlier I said that's like asking me about oxygen? Like, I don't think people slip into manipulation. How do I do it? By not manipulating. You know, like, I think that there's a lot of things in our society that we don't have the right conversation around. You know, this goes back to intent. For me, if you're asking me personally, because I know that I would die if I tried to hurt someone. That's how. It's just innate. When people talk about these things, it's because they're not living it. Right? So like, do you post on social at scale? And so are you asking from the framework of you being concerned that you may do that?
I don't know if I'm like not preaching the right stuff.
But you'll like this. That is more about imposter syndrome and insecurity than it is about the intent to manipulate. Right? That's you questioning yourself if you're doing that. But there's certain things when you write, when you housewife, when you cook, when you listen to music, whatever it is, think about for a few seconds the things that you do easiest and best. You don't worry about that. And so that's how I think about it. I think about it like driving. Like when you first start driving, you think about it so much. You're so scared, you know, like you're like two hands and like, and then like 10 years later, you're barely paying attention. That's how I think about this. Like, when you ask that question, you're asking it from your perspective. I think you just need to do it more and get comfortable with it. But you're not gonna go down some bad path. You're not gonna find yourself stumbling into manipulating.
Hi Gary, I'm Miriam. Sorry. I'm Miriam Filer. My birthday is the 5th of the 5th.
I love it.
And my NFT project, New Day Tomorrow, is actually the first drop to the Gift Goats in November 2021.
So amazing.
I'm very thrilled to be here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're on my vision board. We can podcast together. So put it out there. I think what's worrying me as a parent with social media is that there are players out there that can get in trouble and be awful and evil, yet still are able to have a voice now with social media. So I just wanted your thoughts on that and what can be done.
There's plenty of dictators around the world before social media came along. I think we're very bad at understanding that the things that we're worried about with social media are actively going on at all times. Yeah, but the question becomes what and how does that play out? So for me, raising children, thinking about the world, I don't get scared because I think parents have the ultimate control. Parents have resigned their ultimate control because parenting has evolved. Parents are not as good at accountability as they used to be. Parents want to be their children's friends more than their parents. So very few parents that parent are struggling with this because they're teaching their children self-esteem, what's right and what's wrong, and they're having the conversation. I understand the concept of it's become entertainment, but the reality is that the world always has a lot of messaging, right? And I think it's your job and ask them why and help them critically think. I think the biggest issue when we talk about the way the world is today is that we've really lost our way as parents. I really believe that. And by the way, when I talk about this, is a general statement. There's unbelievable amounts of parents that are doing what they need to be doing, but I think a lot of parents have, they think that they are hopeless. They think like, well, my kid has a phone and she or he, like, I don't believe that to be true. You know, almost all of us rebelled against our parents in high school, but all those deposits that our parents put into us, you realize later it was there. So I would encourage parents to do more parenting. You know, given what I do for a living, you can imagine, people literally stop me in the middle of the street, and like, I really don't like TikTok. I'm like, all right, like, have a nice day. Like, if I indulge them and have a 2-minute combo at the airport, I'll be like, okay, like, what's the context? Well, my kid, I'm like, take it off their phone. We are in the greatest era of blame. We have been addicted in the last 10 years to pointing fingers. And I think we have to get back to pointing thumbs. If you don't like TikTok and you don't like your kid being on it, don't let your kid be on it. Don't stop me in the middle of the street and tell me you don't like TikTok. Start being a parent and ground your children. Take their phone away. Punish them. My mom did. Like grounding has been eliminated. What kid gets grounded? That's the problem, not TikTok. You don't like TikTok? Take his shit away.
Yeah. I'm Dirk. Won't tell too much about my background, but when I was listening to you, you said, play your own game. I'm a very big advocate of social media. Then you had empathy. In between all that, how do you filter out the noise?
By recognizing that it isn't real. Like, when you describe noise, click into it a little bit. What noise?
If you post,
yep.
You also watch a lot of social media, you just advocate that social media, you know, is a key thing, a key connector in society, so I assume that you consume it a lot as well?
Well, I don't consume it. I consume it with purpose. So I'm not consuming social media like the masses. I'm consuming it to understand why people are interested in things. But on a Sunday afternoon, I will watch 4 hours of an American football game for escapism. It's okay to watch a movie. It's okay to be in your social media for 2 hours. It happens. It's not like I'm a robot. Is that what you mean by noise?
Because there's so much on social platforms, that can distract you.
Yeah, but so was television. you know, again, back to us in this room, everything we say about social media today, we said about video games and MTV and television. There's always distractions. I will say this as a parting thought, I know we have to go. Hearing so many people just say accountability means the world to me. I can tell you, to wrap it all the way back to the beginning, all of my happiness, all of my peace of mind, all of my ability to be content on an everyday basis, all of the lack of anxiety is completely based on accountability. Once you feel like it's your fault, most people think that's like a bad thing. We've taught everybody to get away from that. It's actually the reverse. Because once you feel like it's your fault, you feel that you can fix it. That's it. Very powerful.